From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Sunset District?
In between Cupertino and Saratoga.
San Jose.
Oakland.
Antioch.
Half Moon Bay.
Yeah, same here, Half Moon Bay.
Coming up, we'll visit a high school in Oakland that's taking a new approach to tackling the dropout problem.
But a student wants to know, how did you do it? You know, coming from where I'm coming from, how did you make this happen?
Then a bad breakup leads a local author to his next book idea.
I thought, I need to crack this case out of necessity for myself, but maybe along the way I'll be able to help other people.
And why a San Francisco local is trying to think like an out-of-towner.
I think whenever you have that tourist mentality, when you have that traveler mentality, then more friendliness comes towards you.
We're getting experimental today on Cross Currents. Today, we're diving into some of the innovation and experimentation happening around the Bay Area. We'll start in the Oakland Unified School District, where several high schools have implemented a new solution to an old problem, the dropout dilemma. More specifically, they're trying to keep African-American males in school. In 2011, 30% of African-American students in Oakland dropped out, about double the rate statewide. Among the most likely to leave were young black men. And this week, the San Francisco Chronicle reported another staggering statistic. In the last 10 years, the number of black males killed in Oakland just about matched the number who graduated from high school ready to go to college. Improving the odds for these young men is a big undertaking, but the staff at Oakland High School thinks it's possible. It's one of seven schools participating in a district project called the Manhood Development Program, a daily after-school class that aims to keep young men in school and help them build life skills. Reporter Angela Hopkins visited the Manhood Development Program at Oakland High School earlier this year. She takes us inside the class in this story from our archives.
I'm walking alongside the mural called Beautiful Struggle in front of Oakland High School. Frida Kahlo, Che Guevara, and Malcolm X are just a few of many social activists portrayed here. This mural also reflects a student body made up predominantly of students of color. 51% are Asian, 29% black, 16% Latino, and 1% white. After I've entered the school's gate, guarded by security officers, I'm free to roam the hallway in search of the Manhood Development Program's office. It's here where I meet Mr. Tiago Robinson.
I dropped out in ninth grade. I didn't have me when I was going in school. I couldn't relate to anyone.
Robinson has been running the Manhood Development Program at Oakland High since 2009.
I mean, you hear all these things like, you know, go to school, stay in school, but nobody really actually teach you how to do those things. It's just easier to say, hey, go to class.
Robinson doesn't just say, go to class. It's his job to teach these boys how to become men.
So manhood is just really just teaching them how to be a young man, how to be accountable for your actions.
How to be accountable, but also how to learn life's lessons.
You are going to make mistakes, but it's how you make your mistake and how you learn from your mistake and getting up and just striving to be the best that you can be.
Being the best you can be is no easy task. According to recent reports, 20% of African-American males are chronically absent, while suspension rates for African-American males are six times higher than that of whites. The Manhood Development Program is stressing the importance of education in the most realistic way possible.
My brother's 2 years older than me. He's 36 years old. He has been a gangster rapper since we were 14. Y'all find it funny, I know.
Wearing a variety of hoodies, blue jeans, and baseball caps, 14 young Afro-American men, along with Robinson, are gathered to hear Mr. Flagg speak. But this isn't just any ordinary classroom. This manhood development class is where guest speakers like Flagg come every week to talk about how education can provide options to the street life.
So my brother has been, you know, doing this for a long time, man. I came into the kitchen one time, my parents were going, he had a razor blade, he had an old, like, little aspirin or Excedrin or something. He was carving this thing up. I'm like, what are you doing?
Cutting rocks.
He's cutting some rocks, man. I tell the story to say he dropped out of school in the ninth grade. That was his last year of high school. Hayward High, he dropped out. And to make little ends meet now, he has a whole pickup truck. He drives around and he helps folks haul their stuff. That's his hustle.
Unlike his brother, Mr. Flagg is a college graduate and currently represents Hild College. Later during this visit, he will also discuss college programs the students may be interested in. But first, they'll have to get college ready. That's Jasmine Noble's job, another manhood development mentor.
We are preparing just, you know, for them to take exams so they know how to fill out the different CSUs, UC applications, community college.
College readiness is just one phase of the program. Getting through to them is another matter entirely.
Okay, you're dealing with 9th and 10th graders, you know. First of all, they don't know you. You have to build trust. You have to bridge that gap. So just giving them like a little history about me, they respect that because, again, it's like children, youth, they're going to watch you more than anything. You can give them a full hour lecture of all the scholarship opportunities you may have, but a student wants to know, how did you do it? You know, coming from where I'm coming from, how did you make this happen? And I think that's the most important thing that I can show. And I can come with resources that can be used.
Like her students, Jasmine grew up in Oakland's inner city and says she attended subpar schools. Eventually, however, she reached college.
I still kept my goal. You know, it took me 7 years to finish undergrad, but I had a goal and I stuck to it.
She stuck to it through hardship and grief. One of her brothers was murdered.
You know, and then I share that with my students sometimes, and they respect that because, unfortunately, you know, the natural cause of a lot of African-American males in the inner-city communities is homicides, you know. So it's like, unfortunately, that's the topic of discussion. But I also let the students know that's not normal. That's, you know, that's something's wrong with that. And so I just use that as my motivation.
Utilizing motivation like that is one of the goals of the manhood development class. As I continue to sit in on the session, Mr. Flagg tells the inspirational story of African-American boxer Andre Ward, who grew up in the East Bay, trained at a gym in Oakland, and eventually fought his way to a gold medal at the 2004 Olympics.
For boxing, right, if you're in the gym, you prepare for a major title fight. Your gym, you might have one speed bag, an old kind of worn out heavy bag, and that's about it, right? But the fighter you're training against, state-of-the-art facility, can you still out-train that person?
Yeah.
Can you still put yourself in a better situation to out and fight?
Yeah.
What does it take?
Hard work.
Dedication.
Initiatives.
Oh, man, I love all those words.
Effort.
All of that. Hard work, initiative, dedication. All right. Now, some folks are in a fight, they don't even know they're getting ready for a fight. They don't even know that you're getting ready for a fight. So they're not even trained. They don't even hit the bag once.
Fighting your way through obstacles is one of the many themes of the Manhood Development Program. Jasmine Noble says hearing from successful Black men is teaching them what it is to be a man.
Them also seeing, you know, Black men who've went to college and just like seeing it for themselves, you know, people that can relate to them. I think that's the goal of the program, to actually see. So if you see, you can believe it, you know, and kind of like teaching them what faith is by actually seeing it, because sometimes that can be abstract for a lot of people.
Tiago Robinson wants to make sure this program is concrete, not abstract.
If they fell in a class, it's mandatory that they have to make that class up. So they have to spend out of the week at least 2 days with that teacher to kind of figure out what went wrong. And I do that is because then they build a relationship with their teacher. And then also they can kind of see, you know, where they made their mistakes. So the next 6 weeks, that grade would go up.
I asked Tiago why he thinks the Manhood Development Program matters.
It matters because it's important. I think it's good to pass the torch on to the younger generation to do what they want to do. Because, you know, I'm going to be an old man at one point, and I want them to be able to take care of the country and take care of the city and run things the right way. And I think they can do it, but they just need to be taught.
Although there is no easy way out of Oakland's inner city, through hard work, initiative, dedication, and courage, these 9th and 10th graders have a fighting chance of making their dreams come true. Take a moment and listen to some of the dreams students shared with me.
My name is Barry Williams, and what I see myself doing
is being an owner of Sony.
My name is Jesse, and I see myself as a fire chief and a doctor.
My name is Kenneth. I see myself going into the Navy.
My name is Naquan. I see myself as somebody in criminal justice, a lawyer, or a chef.
My name is Byron, and I see myself as an engineer.
My name is James, and I see myself being a lawyer.
My name is Rico, and I want to be an engineer.
My name is Tiago, and I see myself doing what I'm doing.
Which is trying to steer his Oakland High students to college and success beyond high school. I'm Angela Hopkins for Cross Currents.
Angela Hopkins produced that story as a student reporter for Mills College in Oakland. So what lessons did you learn about manhood growing up or wish you'd learned? Let us know on our tip line, 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Leave us a message and we might share your story on the air. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Today we're looking at the creative solutions people in the Bay Area are coming up with to make lives here better. If the statistics in that last story scared you, you might seek advice from Jamal Yogis. He's the author of the book, The Fear Project, What Our Most Primal Emotion Taught Me About Survival, Success, Surfing, and Love. In it, he takes an experiential approach to getting over some of his own fears by confronting them head on. He tells stories of swimming with sharks, forcing himself to do public presentations, and surfing giant waves. Along the way, he also spoke with researchers about the science behind our fears. KALW's Martina Castro talked with Jamal Yogis about his findings, and they say a lot about our society as a whole.
I was realizing just how prevalent anxiety disorders are in this country. You know, 40 million Americans is the official statistic of suffering from an anxiety disorder every year. It's probably much more than that. That's the diagnosed. And, you know, this is interesting because we live at a time in history when we live longer, we live healthier, we live safer lives than any other time in history, despite the way it feels when you turn on the news. Those are just the facts. We will, you know, if you have a child today, the chance they'll live to 100 is much greater than at any time in human history. So in a lot of ways we live safer, but we're feeling more and more scared. And so I thought, I need to crack this case out of necessity for myself, but maybe along the way I'll be able to help other people.
Well, so what can you tell us, what is happening in your body when you feel fear or when fear kicks in?
What's happening when you feel fear is that a very ancient part of your brain called the amygdala, it's often referred to as the lizard brain because we share it with lizards. It goes that far back, you know, hundreds of millions of years, is telling your adrenal glands to release adrenaline and cortisol, a stress hormone. And what those two get to work doing is speeding up your heart rate, shutting down your immune system, shutting down your digestion, shutting down your sex drive. And the reason for that is, like, those are all future projects. And so your body's saying, let's put all those future projects off until we survive this moment. But when it gets to be chronic, where that energy is always there, and then your immune system isn't working over a long period of time, it's like, that's when it can make us sick and it makes us not feel well. Or if it gets too high into panic, it can make us freeze up or have a panic attack or act really irrationally. So that's the basic picture. And the interesting thing about that amygdala sending that message is that you don't control it at all.
I really enjoyed some of the tests that you did on yourself in the book, because you really brought it alive. And especially that moment when you hook yourself up to that shock tester thing. Can you describe what was actually happening? And to me, that I think that was like a really good example of the fear of fear.
Yeah. I really think it's that fear of fear and the worry about worry that hurts more than the initial impulse. But yeah, Daniela Schiller, this wonderful neuroscientist who at the time was at NYU, took me down into her lab, and she hooked me up to a zapper a la Peter Venkman in Ghostbusters. And she said, try to figure out this pattern on the screen. And I saw a pattern of blue and yellow squares. And I realized right away that the blue squares sometimes came with this shock. So I saw the squares for a few minutes, and then she showed me a graph of my fear, which was reflected by the sweat on my skin that she was measuring, the most minute changes in sweat. And it was interesting because the first time there was a shock blue square pairing, I got a spike of fear from the shock. But then every time after that, I would get an equal fear response from just seeing the blue square with no shock. So the anticipation that a shock might come was suddenly as jarring to my body as actual pain. And this is where humans really differ from some of our animal friends, is that we have this ability to trigger the amygdala, this very dramatic fear response, with a mere thought.
I'm speaking with Jamal Yogis, author of The Fear Project, What Our Most Primal Emotion Taught Me About Survival, Success, Surfing, and Love. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Martina Castro. So well, I think it's a good transition into strategies to deal with fear. It seems like you really focused on athletes and how they have concrete strategies that they go to when they're feeling performance anxiety or maybe even fear of fear.
Yeah, well, there are so many strategies. And the number one way to deal with fear, as most of the neuroscientists told me, is exposure therapy. And it's so simple. And it's also the hardest to get yourself to do, because you have to do what you're afraid of. And so if you are afraid of heights, you know, getting yourself to jump out of that airplane is going to be the thing that is most helpful, but you might not want to jump out of the airplane right away. You want to take baby steps. So, you know, watching a film about maybe skydiving while you're holding your wife's hand or something, and then getting yourself to go to some taller three-story buildings and four-story buildings. You know, taking those baby steps, because what you want is a positive association with the fear, or at least a neutral one. Of course, there are different strategies for different types of fear. So if you're having what's called a bottom-up fear response, where you see a scary wave, you know, a 40-foot wave is coming at you, and that fear is sort of starting in your body, and breathing through it is going to be the way to address that fear. So that's why soldiers and special forces learn to breathe evenly in the midst of these very high stress situations to bring down their fear response.
And do you use these now that you know them? Are these coming up in your brain when you have fears?
Yeah, I mean, I still have lots of fears, and they just don't go away completely. And
you don't have to just write a book about fear and it goes away.
I wish. But to some extent, I don't wish, because now I realize there are really great values to fear. And so I catch myself faster saying, instead of being frustrated with myself for feeling afraid, I say, oh my gosh, well, isn't this so normal and natural that there are these uncertain things in the future and I feel this way? And oftentimes just that can turn the fear around, just that catching it and noticing it and giving yourself permission to feel it. All of a sudden you're like, oh, okay, now I can actually get down to the practicalities of what I need to do. I mean, the funny thing about when you start researching the science of fear is, like, you're like, oh, we already all know this stuff. You know, it's like faith helps, love helps, exercise helps. You know, just doing it helps, going into your fears help. It's like, duh. But when you're in fear, oftentimes you start mistrusting all your intuition. And so you're like, I don't know what to do. I'm just going to dig deeper into this hole. And so that's where the science helps.
And I like, actually, I think at some point you write about how the actual feeling, or of the act of being in love, can help you conquer fear.
Yeah. One, on a chemical level, anytime you're in love, you have a lot of oxytocin in your system. And oxytocin is this neurochemical that they've shown in studies helps counteract the freezing response of fear. So like rats who are being shocked, if they have a little oxytocin in their system, instead of freezing, they will still feel fear, but they'll be able to move through that. And the amazing thing is you can actually, you know, you or I can close our eyes and think of someone we love or think of being loved by our moms. And we actually get a little hit of oxytocin if we really take the time to feel it. And so that's accessible anytime. So when you're, you know, going into a scary situation, actually, you know, doing that hokey thing of like closing your eyes and thinking of people who love you is helpful.
That was author Jamal Yogis speaking with KALW's Martina Castro. You can read more of Yogis's findings on fear in his book, The Fear Project. Find a link to that on our website at kalw.org. And what are your fears, and what have you done to try and overcome them? Tell us on our Facebook page, KALW. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Jamal Yogis went hunting for the roots to his fears. The man in our next story found a way to up the happiness in his life. And it turns out he had the solution inside him all along. KALW's Brooke Welty encountered him as part of her Kindness Project, in which she traveled the country interviewing random people about their experiences receiving kindness from others. She spoke with women at a rehab center in Birmingham, Alabama, and with a blues singer in Memphis.
That's what I realized, how much they had grown, and I mean, I didn't even recognize them. And that's when I realized that I wanted more. I wanted to be a mom again, a good mom. A real mom.
Yet I live in New York, and it's there. That same kindness is in every place. It's a different type of seasoning.
A diner owner in Branson, Missouri.
There's a lot of good people out there yet. We hear about all the bad.
And an ex-Marine in Steamboat, Colorado.
He put the doc's life and the life of his men at a higher status than his own.
And at the Alamany Flea Market here in San Francisco, she met Ali Benazir, who told her about his secret key to kindness.
So I'm relatively new here, and so I talk to people, I say hi, it's like, hi, I'm new to the neighborhood. I sit down with random people, I talk to random people, and you know, people buy me drinks out of nowhere, I'm like, oh, that's interesting, right? Yeah, it's kind of that, I think whenever you have that tourist mentality, when you have that traveler mentality, then more friendliness comes towards you.
Ali Benazir first learned this when he was traveling at age 17. He had spent a few days in Montreal and was coming back to his school in Cambridge, Massachusetts, when the bus dropped him off far from his campus and far from the T, Boston's main transit system.
It stops like 30 miles outside of Boston, the city called Woburn, or Woburn, as they say in Boston. So now it's around 10:30 p.m. I'm in Woburn. I've got these huge bags I don't know what to do with. And I'm running around trying to look for a T station, but there is no T station in Woburn. So finally, out of sheer desperation, I knock on a door where the light was still on. It's already pretty late at night, it's a Sunday night. And this nice lady comes out and she says, what can I do for you? And she said, I say, hey, where is this mythical, legendary commuter rail station so I can get back home? And she's like, oh, you're lost. I'm like, yeah. So, and she looks at my bag and says, let me give you a ride. So she packs my stuff into the back of her station wagon, you know, drives me, you know, the 5-minute drive to the commuter rail station, which I would have never otherwise found. I catch the last commuter rail coming into Boston, and I make it home safe and sound around midnight. All because of the kindness of the lady. It was totally unexpected. I was like, holy cow, that's very nice. I think whenever you open yourself to being helped, then that kind of thing has a space to happen.
Since that night, Ali has tried to practice this kind of openness in his regular life instead of saving it for when he's in a foreign place.
So is that going to be one of your goals living in San Francisco, to kind of keep that tourist mentality so that you keep this up?
Well, it's funny you should mention that, Brooke, because I've decided that I'm going to be a tourist here forever.
And in a way, I feel like I've decided to do that too.
Ali Benazir is an author and a hypnotherapist in the Bay Area. He spoke with KALW's Brooke Welty at the Alamany Flea Market in San Francisco for her Kindness Project, documenting stories about acts of kindness throughout the country. Find a link to her blog with more stories like that at KALW.org. And if you have a story of kindness to share, let us know on our tip line, 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. And that's all for today's edition of Cross Currents. The team includes Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Alyssa Kapnick, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Daniel Moore, Liz Pfeffer, Leah Rose, Seth Samuel, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. This is the San Francisco Lyric Chorus under the direction of Robert Gurney. The chorus will be performing Ein Deutsches Requiem by Johannes Brahms for their summer concert. That's at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in San Francisco on Saturday at 7 and again on Sunday at 5 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.